Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Oh, my. Oh, my. This is the first of three. We're going to do a series of podcasts on Dante's Divine Comedy.
Mm-hmm.
So the first one is Inferno, the famous one.
It's the one everybody reads, even if they don't read the others.
Yeah, yeah. So, it's the first of three. The other two being Purgatorio and Paradiso, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so... Yeah, so Dante played for Manchester United in 1300. Oh, do I have the wrong guy? Oh, shoot. I prepared completely incorrectly for this.
I think it was Florence United if he was playing for them. He would have wished, anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
He hadn't been kicked out.
Right. Well, Dante did live right around 1300. I think he was born in 1265.
Mm-hmm.
And died. Did he die in exile?
Yes, 1321.
Okay. 1321.
He was exiled in 1308.
And exiled by whom and from where?
Oh, who? Lord. Well, okay, yeah. This is going to be the simplest gloss. Anybody who really knows about Dante, just have to listen for what we thought about it, because I only have the basic grasp. But there were two political parties that battled for power all the time, the Guelphs and the Ghibellines. And there were the Blacks and the Whites.
And this is in Florence.
This is in Florence.
Okay.
And at that time, in order to be anybody, you had to belong to your city and you had to belong to a political party. And I can't remember which one. See, this is why it's so shallow. I can't remember which one he belonged to. But at one point, he was caught on the wrong side and they trumped up all these charges of graft and extortion and all these various things. And exiled him under the pain of being burned alive if they caught him back in the city limits, basically.
Ooh, bummer.
He never returned. And so he left everybody and everything he loved and was in exile. And for us, that was a good thing because it made him get more serious about his writing. He was always a poet. But he had written several things and he continued writing. And a lot of them are unfinished. So you can see that he was working on different stuff, and if you read anything about him, and most of the books I have always go into this stuff, what influenced him, all these things, and they point out that you can see him kind of working through issues and concepts for himself, of course, as he's doing this, and it culminates in what he called the comedy. Everybody else called it the Divine Comedy after they read it. He just called it the comedy because in classical thinking, this was very helpful for me. A comedy goes from chaos to order with a happy ending. A tragedy goes from order to chaos with a sad or tragic ending. And when I knew that, I went, oh, I suddenly understand a lot more about a lot of these, you know, Shakespearean things, all these, various situations.
Yeah,
you're watching it fall apart or come together.
Right.
Yeah.
So he wrote this while in exile, right?
Mm-hmm.
He wrote it. So I think he started it in 1308, we figured,
mm-hmm.
or we looked up. And,
something like that, yeah.
And he passed away in 1321.
Yeah. And as soon as he finished it and it came out, I think his son started writing notes to help explain it to everybody. And...
Well, that's a relief because, I don't see how a person could read this without notes. Though, you know, the words are clear enough. There are so many names and, that I would have had no idea who I was reading about.
Also, classical allusions to mythology.
Yeah, lots of mythological figures and lots of figures from that are contemporaries of his.
Mm-hmm.
Which I had mixed feelings about. When I was reading it, I thought, he's throwing all these people that he knows into hell. You know, is he like condemning them? Is that what he was doing? Was he actually just naming people's sins and throwing them in this book?
I don't think so, because, and this is one of those things that I always have to struggle with till I find the right note and go, oh yeah. But one thing I know that helps put it in context is, and it's one of the reasons why you have to go ahead and read the whole thing.
The whole thing, meaning all three. Okay.
Not just the first one.
Yeah.
Is it's not fair to Dante himself otherwise, because it does look like he's just throwing everyone he doesn't like under the bus. And when you think about it, if you were writing this, if you updated it like we've seen science fiction people do and horror people like to take this setting and update it, it's tempting. Because you can look at somebody else and so clearly see, why are they blind? They cannot see this about themselves. I'm going to put them here and use them as this example because everyone knows who they are. They'll understand what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But when you read Purgatory and Paradise, what you find is there are people who were enemies of his who are in those places.
Hmm. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, and I'm fairly sure, and I would have had to have looked it up, but I'm fairly sure that, you know, one of the most distressing parts for me is early on, kind of like the antechamber to hell, there are the virtuous pagans who didn't have a chance to know Christ, and they're just kind of there in this boring place together. So they're not being tortured, but they can't go to heaven. Mm-hmm. So they're tortured by the fact that they can never go to heaven. And that's in line with the Catholic theology of the time, but also in line with the fact that he's working through and trying to understand how all these things apply to us. I believe it's when he gets to one of the levels of paradise, you find one of those virtuous pagans who made it. Huh. Because he did understand Christ through how he was living and what he was understanding at the time. So he never just leaves it all as a one-dimensional judgment. And if you don't read all of them, it does look like, as you wrote to me in an email, like he's mm-hmm. giving them the finger. But it's everything together is more nuanced. And so, as I started to say, the example I give is if you only read Inferno, it's as if you're only reading the Fellowship of the Ring.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And not the whole Lord of the Rings.
Well, cool. All right. Well, I look forward to the other two. And yeah. I genuinely do, because this was fascinating.
So did you like it then?
I did like it. It's like I liked that I have read it. You know what I mean? it's one of those things that you read and every now and then you come across a line that you've read somewhere else because someone has picked it up. You know, like the famous, abandon all hope, all ye who enter here.
Yes.
You know, so you see that and it's like, oh, all these literary allusions kind of click into place, even though I may have known where it came from, but now it's, I got all this context and stuff. So mm-hmm. it is well worth reading. And the other thing, I mean, the imagination right? and the imagery in these words is really stunning. I have images in my head that, you know, didn't come from the notes that I read. And by the way, I read the Musa translation, Mark Musa.
Yeah,
we
both read that.
Okay.
Yeah.
We talked about how we need notes, but this thing had really good notes. I enjoyed the notes, mm-hmm. but I don't have anything to compare it with. But you've read more than this one. So did you like the notes in the Musa version?
Yeah, I actually really did like the notes in this one. Mm-hmm. And each version I've read, which makes it sound like I'm super deep, I am not. I have skimmed the surface of each one, mm-hmm. but has a different value to their notes. Like I read Anthony Isolin, if that's how you say his name. I read his version. His notes were interesting because they had the basics, but he also started off each chapter's notes with this little head note, kind of a little mini reflection from a Catholic point of view. So that was interesting. John Ciardi's notes were more basic, but he had this amazing essay at the beginning about how to read Dante that was wonderful. I liked Mark Musa's because his, unlike some, were not super extensive. I didn't need to know every single thing about all these historical characters, and so he kind of pared it down to, what do you need to know about why this person is here, you know? And some of the notes will be more extensive about all that. So,
okay.
And I also liked that he would do this kind of summary, you know, like, here's his mastery of techniques and why, how they all hold together. And you go, oh, they didn't get that. Yeah, I would say in my limited knowledge that it doesn't matter as much what translation you read, as long as the translation is easy to understand for you and complete, not one of these, here's my modern take on it, but an actual translation, and that you, the notes are helpful to you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep, agreed.
But I liked this. I liked it a lot.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I found it good too. So I just opened it to the very first canto. And just an example of some of the imagery. The pilgrim in this is Dante himself, right? So as it opens, he's like wandering around the woods, not sure how he got there, but he's getting afraid. But I'll just read a couple of lines here. But it says, "How I entered there, I cannot truly say. I had become so sleepy at the moment when I first strayed, leaving the path of truth. But when I found myself at the foot of a hill, at the edge of the wood's beginning, down in the valley, where I first felt my heart plunge deep in fear, I raised my head and saw the hilltop shawled in the morning rays of sunlight sent from the planet that leads men straight ahead on every road." I just really like it. The imagery, I'm right there. I mean, in very few words, it's like I can see where he is. And that's where the whole thing is, you know, when he goes into hell and we're going through these 9 circles of hell, his descriptions in a very short space have resonance with me anyway. I had no problem feeling that I was present, and that surprised me.
Yeah, and also, even in the circles where you're going,
there's plenty of that.
But because Dante is there both as the pilgrim and as the poet, sometimes he'll pull out and kind of make a little comment. And you'll go, oh, that's kind of like the omniscient narrator. But because he's there, he's afraid. He's worried. He feels sympathy for characters where you're going, yeah, that doesn't seem right. You know, the real famous ones that everybody's sorry for, Francesca and Paolo. And Virgil's continually having to go, don't feel sorry for them. They put themselves here. And then you have to pull back and say, oh, wait, she's lying to us, if I really think about it. But because he does that, he knows kind of how you feel. And he's very skillfully, kind of very gradually teaching you, what do you have to know to be able to recognize sin? And because we're also the pilgrim, because one of the things, these are some of the most famous lines in the whole thing. It starts with, "Midway along the journey of our life, I woke to find myself in a dark wood, for I had wandered off from the straight path." How hard it is to tell what it was like, this wood of wilderness, savage and stubborn. The thought of it brings back all my old fears, a bitter place. And you look at it and you go, first of all, he says our life. Mm-hmm. It's not just him. It's all of us. So he's taking us with him. And second of all, it's like you said from the part you read, which is just a little further on. We know we can imagine it, the real woods, but we also know what he's talking about internally. How did we lose our way?
Yeah.
And we've all been there. And when you read that part out loud, I thought, oh my gosh, this is like somebody who's, it's that horrible stab of fear when you first realize I am in deep trouble.
Yeah, and the line right after that I'd like to read, because then he switches really to from imagery to emotion, and it's really touching. He says, "And then only did terror start subsiding in my heart's lake, which rose to heights of fear that night I spent in deepest desperation. Just as a swimmer, still with panting breath, now safe upon the shore, out of the deep, might turn for one last look at the dangerous waters, so I, although my mind was turned to flee, turned round to gaze once more upon the past that never let a living soul escape."
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, that's touching.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole thing's like that, you know?
Yeah.
But he's talking about the most creative, amazing things.
What an imagination.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, really something else.
And I would like to mention really quickly while we're talking, before we get off on translations and versions and everything, there is an Audible, and it's available other ways, I'm sure, version read by, is it Heathcote Williams?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was very good.
Yeah, it's, I believe the translation's by Benedict Flynn, but you can really listen to it while you're reading a different, I mean, not at the same time, but as a supplement to reading it, because it really kind of, he gives it a richness and depth hearing those words too.
Yeah, I agree. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Good stuff. So that was great advice from you to do that.
Yeah. I was so pleased to find it. And then the fact that, you know, he's changing his voice and you're getting who some of these are, and it really kind of helps. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
yeah. So how do we proceed? We've read out of Canto 1. So from there, he runs into the three beasts.
He starts to go up the hill because he sees the star or the sun, I guess. He wants to go toward the light. So he's going to go straight up that hill.
Stay away from the light.
Yeah. But in this, light is, of course, God. And the pilgrim's goal is always to reach the light. So... But, yeah, those three beasts get in his way.
So a leopard, a lion, and a wolf, a she-wolf. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it says in the notes that the leopard represents fraud, which is a canto that comes later. And
the hell, yeah.
Right, and the lion symbolizes all forms of violence. And the she-wolf represents the different types of concupiscence. Did I say that right?
Yeah, I think so.
So,
what is that?
Strong sexual desire and lust.
Oh, okay,
and
lust. I think
incontinence. What is incontinence in this context?
Yeah,
incontinence.
Lack of control. Then
it might just be lack of control, right? Lack of general control, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, failure to restrain sexual appetite.
Yeah,
that's interesting. And he made that a she-wolf.
Well, and also other people have other interpretations for this.
Okay.
In fact, I was looking at something. It might have been one of my books that I have on Dante. And they were saying, these things seem like this to me. And they said, but Mark Musa says there are these things.
Okay.
So different people have different interpretations. But I would say the thing that's interesting is it's interesting talking about it like this.
Mm-hmm.
There are three of them.
Yeah.
And I believe Mark Musa anyway, and probably others, say that they represent the three basically subdivisions of hell. These are the three things that everything falls into. And so everything Dante does is in threes. You know, there's introductory canto, mm-hmm. and then there's the 33 cantos of hell. There's the three parts of the comedy. There's the three. And because, of course, the Trinity is three.
Yeah,
and what
yeah.
you see is everything in hell is a perversion of everything that's good. And you a lot of times will see there are three sections to this part. There are three. I mean, everything is in threes. And when you get down to the bottom, think about.
And there were three faces on Lucifer, too.
Yeah, that's a perversion of the Trinity.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, and think what he's doing. He's eating people instead of helping them.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
Yeah, munch, munch.
Anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
So he meets those three beasts, and then someone comes to help him out.
Yeah, because he runs away, and somebody comes to help him, and it's Virgil.
Yeah, and Virgil, who wrote the Aeneid, right? Aeneid, I think that's how it is.
Yeah, I think so.
And that's interesting because there is a lot of mythological creatures.
Yeah.
Figures. There's a lot of mythological figures in this. And I guess that surprised me, you know, this being 1300, that was the common... was it entertainment, I wonder? I mean... He's clearly talking about something that everybody knows about. Don't you think? Yeah. Am I incorrect in assuming that?
I think so, because one of his or at least on the most surface level, because one of his innovations, which we forgot to mention, is that he wrote it in ordinary Italian, which nobody would have done back then. It was real innovative, but it meant that he wanted everybody to be able to read it.
Okay.
And in fact, he inspired Geoffrey Chaucer, who took a trip to Italy and encountered, you know, Dante and not himself, I don't think, but the poem and everything, and went back and wrote the Canterbury Tales in regular English, they say.
I see.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, so he was talking to everybody using language and characters that they knew.
Right.
So that tells me that, you know, around the campfire and, you know, at night, they're telling each other stories of Greek and Roman mythology. And that surprised me, because I would have thought that they would have kind of, that would have fell away, I guess. But, it didn't.
Okay, I could be wrong. But my impression is that, for one thing, our education is shameful compared to even the beginning of the 19th century. I mean, the 20th century. Sorry, the 1900s, shall I say. Sure. Everybody had to read these Greeks and learn about all this stuff. And now they just kind of skip over it and have you reading The Catcher in the Rye or whatever. And so they aspired a lot of the time to know what all those classical people did. And an educated man would have learned a lot of that stuff. And so...
Yeah, so I don't know a lot about Florence, so...
Yeah.
Were people generally educated in 1300 in Florence?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. But on the other hand, you also had to be able to read or to listen to it being read to you. Mm-hmm. And then I would also say that the level of education and general knowledge, I think, was a lot greater than we tend to think, because there's that myth about the Dark Ages being a time of no education and all this kind of thing, when actually – that has been shown not to be the case.
Hmm.
The Renaissance people called themselves the Renaissance because they were very proud of themselves and pushing other things. And so there were continuing levels of knowledge about all this stuff that were just growing and growing and growing.
Yeah.
So people would have held on to a lot of that.
Yeah. Hmm. Interesting.
But on the other hand, there were notes coming out as soon as the book came out. So it doesn't mean that all of it was just crystal clear. But I think maybe a lot of the things, like Virgil's version of Ulysses, would have been known. And we just don't know it. I didn't even know Virgil did a version of Ulysses. That's how ignorant I am of all that stuff.
Gotcha. All right.
So Virgil says he'll guide him, but they have to go down into the dark.
Right. And that was interesting. It's, you know, okay, we can't get past those three beasts, so we can get where you're headed if we go through hell and purgatory and heaven. And that's the short way.
Yeah.
I guess, but, you know, it's like, okay, off we go.
And there was something, and I can't believe how long it took me to find this. I was reading something just recently, and it said, the way up or out is down, which mirrors Christian humility. You have to be able to recognize sin before you can reject it and do penance. And I went,
Mises' note that I highlighted, it says, Dante must choose another road because, in order to arrive at the divine light, it is necessary first to recognize the true nature of sin, renounce it, and pay penance for it.
Ah, okay.
So it's exactly what you just said. Yeah.
So, you know, I just totally never thought about that. Yeah. I just don't think about a lot of things. And I went, and also, and I don't know if this was in the version we read or something else, but it's well known. The poem begins on the evening of Good Friday in 1300, which evidently, if you look up all the way the moon was that he's describing, he totally just made all that up as to how it was happening on whichever Friday. But he emerges to come to purgatory on Easter Sunday. So that's like Christ rising from the tomb on Easter Sunday. So we're clearly supposed to think of this as a journey toward Christ.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, that's good info. That's neat.
Yeah.
Cool.
So what happens is Virgil then, because they have to go to get out, they have to go down. He says, but I'll guide you. I'll protect you. And he does. And he takes him through all the phases of hell, and which is done in a circular way. So that's everybody's familiar usually with, you know, which circle of hell is. This is the ninth circle of hell, which is the lowest. And the way he has organized it is you start with the lightest sins. And of course, you work your way down to the center of hell. So it's the most serious sins down there. And they're all kind of grouped in these three areas that we were talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. And then he starts to question himself. I found this a really interesting piece. But why am I to go? Who allows me to? I am not Aeneas. I am not Paul. Neither nor any man would think me worthy. And then this line here, I was among those dead who are suspended when a lady summoned me. She was so blessed and beautiful. I implored her to command me. Eyes of light. Yeah. So Virgil's saying this. Yeah. With eyes of light more bright than any star and low, soft tone, she started to address me in her own language and with an angel's voice. Yeah, so I thought that was interesting. Isn't that the Virgin Mary? And the Virgin Mary, or
I thought that was Beatrice.
Do I have that right? So, but the Virgin Mary is in here somewhere. It's like the Virgin Mary summoned Beatrice or something,
right?
Who talked to Virgil
or summoned Saint Lucia, right? The Virgin Mary took pity on the pilgrim and called Saint Lucia, whose name means light, and Lucia contacted Beatrice.
Okay.
The three heavenly ladies balance the three beasts of the canto. Of canto one.
Right. And then she talked to Virgil, and then Virgil came.
Right. And Beatrice is, she's one of these figures that they love to talk about because he was in love with somebody named Beatrice, but who was married to someone else, but he'd known her since she was 9 years old, kind of thing. And she died young. And this also sent him into a self-reflective period. The real Dante. And she, one of the things he wrote before this was about Beatrice, a long piece. And then she shows up here, and we'll see her again and again as we proceed. And so she's kind of like, she functions on a lot of levels, you know, as a guide, as somebody who loves you, as somebody who wants the best for you, as somebody who you can't lie to later on.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is kind of interesting, too, because Virgil can read Dante's thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, right.
You can't lie to him either. He knows exactly what's going on, and you kind of have to go, you kind of need that because you either get confused or you kind of lie to yourself about stuff.
Mm-hmm. Right,
and,
right.
And none of that's going to work with Virgil. He's going to make sure you see what you have to see.
Yeah, that's cool. That's a good thought. Yeah. And then I highlighted this, and let's see, I'm trying to figure out now who is speaking. But a man must stand in fear of just those things that truly have the power to do us harm, of nothing else, for nothing else is fearsome.
Mm-hmm.
I liked that line quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like Beatrice is saying that.
Okay. Yeah, because it's all about proper perspective, isn't it?
Right.
I mean, all of this... To me, if you take the big picture of what Dante is showing us through all these individuals and you get done with hell and you're thinking back and you realize not one of these people has perspective and is honest with themselves. Every single one of them is lying, blaming other people for their problems, making excuses, or just openly defiant, going, well, this is the best way. If I have to be here because this is it, well, okay. And while they're suffering through these horrible tortures, which reflect their internal sins, you know.
Right, right.
And so the whole thing is, how can you have proper perspective if you don't really examine something? And boy, do we examine.
That's right. So the line before that, because your question searches for deep meaning, I shall explain in simple words, she said, just why I have no fear of coming here. A man must stand in fear of just those things that truly have the power to do us harm, of nothing else, for nothing else is fearsome. And that is exactly what you're saying. That is perspective, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like it very much. That's going in the pool room.
There you go.
Yeah. Because it does give your life a little perspective too, you know. And it's not just the word fear, but, you know, what you allow to affect you.
Yeah.
You know, some things are not worthy of that.
Well, and there was something I was reading that was saying the whole problem with all of these people that you meet in hell is they didn't have fear of God. And fear of God always into modern ears, like, oh my gosh, you shouldn't be afraid of God. He's love. Well, fear means respect and awe.
Hmm. Yep.
You know, you do something for someone because you love them, because you respect them so much. You take seriously what they say to you because they know better than you, and you give them that power, essentially, kind of like Virgil has. You know, you respect what he says, and he's going to get you through it. And so in that way, Virgil is a reflection of God, you know.
Yeah, fascinating. I like it. So in the next canto, which is 3, now we're going into hell. And this was very interesting to me because this is something that I looked at in myself, you know. In the notes, it says, rejected by God and not accepted by the powers of hell, the first group of souls are nowhere because of their cowardly refusal to make a choice in life. And that's interesting, knowing Dante's past, which you told me this morning that, you know, he was exiled and, you know, that he's writing this sort of as a response in a way to that exile, certainly in the state of that exile. It came mm-hmm. from that. But here he's saying, OK, you've got a group of people that aren't taking any sides. You know, that had to have been frustrating for him.
Well, and Jesus himself, doesn't he say that,
oh, yeah,
you know,
lukewarm, right? Yeah.
I'll spit you out.
Absolutely,
God will spit you
right.
out or whatever, because there's no, you'd be hot or cold, yes or no.
Right. And, you know, I find myself wavering quite a bit. You know, sometimes it's just like, you know, in a day I'm like, well, what about this? What about that? What about this? Kind of floating around in limbo in a way without making a decision.
Well, there's also that aspect of lukewarmness, which means I'm not going to make a decision because it's too much trouble. Either one would make me have to put myself out there and work too hard.
I would have to do something.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And so that's a waste of everything we've been given and who we are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you're kind of denying everything God put you there to do.
Yeah.
You know, even a wrong choice seems, at least it's a choice, you know.
Right. And then we get the famous, before me, nothing but eternal things were made, and I shall last eternally. Abandon every hope, all you who enter. I saw these words spelled out in somber colors, inscribed along the ledge above a gate. Master, I said, these words I see are cruel. And Master, he's talking to Virgil.
Yeah.
So that's the pilgrim speaking to Virgil. Yeah.
What does Virgil say, though?
He says, he answered me, speaking with experience. Now here you must leave all distrust behind. Let all your cowardice die on this spot. We are at the place where earlier I said you could expect to see the suffering race of souls who lost the good of intellect. Placing his hand on mine, smiling at me in such a way that I was reassured, he led me into those mysteries. Here, sighs and cries and shrieks of lamentation echoed throughout the starless air of hell. At first, these sounds resounding made me weep. Yeah.
I would like to read, if you don't mind, right before that. It's
please.
The entirety of the sign that is over the gate of hell. It
Excellent.
Says, I am the way into the doleful city. I am the way into eternal grief. I am the way to a forsaken race. Justice it was that moved my great creator. Divine omnipotence created me, and highest wisdom joined with primal love. Before me, nothing but eternal things were made, and I shall last eternally. Abandon every hope, all who you who enter here. And I remember when I really read the whole thing, and I went, whoa, this is against most modern thinking of all. Justice it was that moved my great creator. Divine omnipotence created me, and highest wisdom joined with primal love. And it's like, love created hell? And one of the points I wanted to make, if people take nothing else away from this, because everybody likes to think about, oh, God is so horrible. You know, look, you made hell. And who, what kind of a God is there who can do that? And I remember when I was in high school, my literature teacher very earnestly saying, you know, it's merciful to just destroy souls. Anybody who'd put them in hell is just monstrous. I can't believe in a God like that, which kind of sums up modern thinking. And John Ciardi says, if you don't mind me just reading this.
No, please. Yeah, go ahead.
He says, he talks about hell as a literal place of sin and punishment. The damned are there because they offended a theological system that enforces certain consequences of suffering. But part of that theological system has also decreed that salvation was available to all men. Christ in his ransom had procured endless mercy. One need only wish to be saved, need only surrender his soul to God in a last gasp of contrition, and he will be saved. He may have to suffer at length in purgatory, but once there, his place is reserved in heaven, and he will in time arrive there. Purgatory is like our modern colleges. No one can flunk out of them. It follows then that the only way to get into hell is to insist upon it. One must deliberately exclude himself from grace by hardening his heart against it. Hell is what the damned have actively and insistently wished for.
Wow. Yeah.
And that's what, if you keep that in mind.
And what did you read from right there?
This is John Ciardi's translation, his C-I-A-R-D-I. And this is one that you will see referred to a lot. People are either going, well, I'm not the great John Ciardi, or, well, John Ciardi, the way he translated it, you know, trying to match the Italian rhyme in his English words. But for a long time, it was the modern translation that everybody turned to. I think it was done in the 60s, maybe. And it's a bit more poetic. And he did try to kind of match the rhythm of the Italian poetry and everything, and a lot of people will just abandon it. This is one thing that people argue about, why which translation is better than the other. Okay, Inferno was done in 54, and he did the copyright for Paradiso is 61. And I only knew of him because for a long time on NPR, there was a little two or three minute thing on words that would pop up every so often, and that was him. He'd talk about where the word fireplace came from, or, you know, so that was obviously his thing. So I was real excited when I found that translation, and it's the first one I read. And the introductory essay is really cool because he also talks about, well, I'm here and then I'll just, which is one of the things that we see. And when you try to pay attention to it, when you're going through hell, it gets kind of overwhelming, which is kind of why you have to read the entire comedy and then maybe even reread, you know, kind of like Lord of the Rings again to get it. But he talks about that the Divine Comedy has often been compared to a cathedral. And he says, whether or not the comparison is apt, it is certainly true that Dante's details keep acquiring significance as one goes on and learns to look back at them from a corresponding point later in the later structure. The structure, that is to say, produces a back illumination. So he talks about there's a ferryman who gets you into hell proper. And he says, but in purgatory, there's an angel pilot who ferries you to purgatory. It says, but you have to, when you compare them to each other is when you start to get fuller illumination of each character and why they're there and what they mean to us.
No, that's and interesting.
So, yeah. So the poem is continually referring back, and there's like it's an example I read was Canto 6 of Hell corresponds to Canto 6 of Purgatory. They're talking about similar sins, but you're seeing the different way people responded, and it corresponds to Canto 6 of Paradise. Again, a further illumination on that similar sin or attitude.
Interesting. Yeah.
So, I mean, this thing is so intricate. I can see why they call it a cathedral.
Right,
so,
right.
So carefully constructed.
Nice.
Anyway, sorry about that.
No, that's wonderful. That's going to be great for looking forward here. Yeah.
Yeah, because that's the thing to me is the whole concept of hell makes a lot of people think of not only God as horrible, but think, oh, this Book of Inferno is just good for looking at Dante as an author.
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't take it seriously. And he, you know, he is a great poet and a great author and all that, but he's also, it's written for one purpose.
Right.
Just to help us all look deeper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it certainly does that. I mean, that's, yeah. When you're done with this, you know, there's that.
Oh, yeah.
You're like, oh, wow, you know. Definitely leaves you in a reflective mood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, cool. So let's see. Again, how should we proceed here? We can't go through every canto.
No.
Or we'll be here for a very long time.
Yeah.
But let's see, should we like maybe select a couple of things that caught us as particularly interesting?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Do you want to go first?
Oh, okay. Well, one of the things that struck me, especially this time through, I don't know why this time through more than the others, but was how the interaction of Virgil and Dante with not with the people who are put in hell, but with the monsters that are there. Because at different stages, there's, you know, Minos who judges everyone and uses his tail to fling them into their proper circle of hell. There are, you know, demons who are there torturing people in different places. There are, there's a monster. What's his name? Guerron? But anyway, he has like, the tail of a scorpion and the body of a lion or something like that, and then the head of a man. And they ride him because one of the things we were both talking about is parts of the architecture of hell have been ruined. You can't get down from one circle to another as smoothly as you used to because there was a huge earthquake at one point. Well, that's when Christ came. You know, the way they say is Christ, you know, when he was before he was resurrected, he went down and got everybody out of hell who'd been kind of waiting around there to for him to come, like, because there was no Christ. So Abraham, Moses, all these people, they were waiting around to go to heaven. So he came, Adam, Eve, came, got them, but it caused a huge earthquake. And so there are all these places they have to kind of slide over or get down or get help with. And so when he's riding that winged scorpion, where Virgil's going, you sit in front of me because that tail will just kill you. I can handle it. You know, and you're just like, how did he think of this stuff? This is just like modern science fiction, you know?
Yeah.
And his description of when he's airborne and what he sees. And I thought, well, you know, they could have gone up into very tall towers and seen things, but nobody was airborne.
Mm-hmm.
So, and what he described seemed right as an airborne view.
Yeah, that's a good
point. And so the interaction that they had with those creatures, because that's a different kind of conversation. It's not, it's having to maneuver and are they lying to us or are they not? We can't tell. We just have to hope or see or go the other way than what they said. That lent that real kind of modern fantasy feel to it to me.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, that you mentioned, you know, a landslide that, you know, that occurred when Christ came down, you know, descended into hell, right? And I learned that was called the harrowing of hell, and that's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So he came down, and you know, there's a bunch of people in there that he took away with him, and like you said, I just love that. And the effect on the landscape, how amazing that must have been, you know, in this world. But yeah, it says, yeah, we've got to go down this landslide. And it said, it just says something like, and it must have been caused by an earthquake or something.
And then
in the notes, it says, yeah, that happened when Christ came down. And yeah, I loved it. The imagery was amazing.
Yeah, I think that's one of those cultural parts that people at the time would have gone, oh, yeah.
Yeah,
we
for sure.
We about this.
Yeah, yeah.
And we've kind of forgotten that now.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, we know what that is. That
yeah.
Is, yeah.
So how about you?
Well, the first thing that leaps to mind, well, there's two things, but the first one is Ulysses. I thought that was really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So Ulysses, of course, is the subject of Homer's Odyssey. And so the first piece of that section, so this is Canto, what is it? 26, XXVI. It took me a minute to translate. So, yeah, so he's, so the pilgrim and Virgil are looking over this scene, and what they're seeing is a bunch of flames. Let's see here. I'm trying to find a representative thing here. How about right here? We started climbing up the stairs of boulders that had brought us to the place from where we watched. My guide went first and pulled me up behind him. We went along our solitary way among the rocks, among the ridges, crags, where the foot could not advance without the hand. I know that I grieved then, and now and then I grieve when I remember what I saw. And more than ever, I restrain my talent, lest it run a course that virtue has not set. For if a lucky star or something better has given me this good, I must not misuse it. As many fireflies, in the season when the one who lights the world hides his face at least, in the hour when the flies yield to mosquitoes, as the peasant on the hillside at his ease sees, flickering in the valley down below, where perhaps he gathers grapes or tills the soil, with just so many flames, all the eight bulgia shone brilliantly, as I became aware when at last I stood where the depths were visible. As he who was avenged by bears beheld Elijah's chariot at its departure, when the rearing horses took to flight toward heaven, and though he tried to follow with his eyes, he could not see more than the flame alone on like a small cloud, once it had risen high. So each flame moves itself along the throat of the abyss, none showing what it steals, but each one stealing nonetheless a sinner. So he's saying that there's these like pillars of flame, and inside each one is a person that's just internally being burned, you know? And so my guide says, there are souls concealed within each of these moving fires, each one swathed in his burning punishment. And one of those is Ulysses. And
you don't expect that.
No, I don't expect that. And the other thing is, you know, like Jason appeared, I think it was earlier.
Oh, yeah.
Jason, you know, from that awesome movie with Harry. Yeah.
He was really Housen, prescient. Right? Wow, Dante really could see the future.
Just amazing, yeah. but then, yeah, Ulysses goes ahead and he tells a story that I wasn't familiar with. And it was like after the Odyssey, Ulysses is like, well, Penelope, I'm glad I'm home, but, you know, I've got things to go see, so I'm leaving. So
just
after that,
came
the
home
whole
for
thing,
cash and get rid of those guys, the right. suitors, and I'm out of here.
Exactly. So he's out of here, and he went on and did his thing. So, it was just fascinating, and that, like you said earlier, there's these conversations with people and creatures, you know, in hell, and in those conversations, there's quite a bit. So it's just fascinating.
Yeah, because when you stop and think about his conversations with people, especially poignant, I found the one with his old teacher,
mm-hmm.
you know, who he respected so much. He's like, oh, you're here too.
Yeah, dang it.
Yeah, exactly. And he still respects him and loves him. But, you know, it's his own actions that got him there. And he's not necessarily even sorry. He's just like, oh, well, you're building on my work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm still very important. Do they talk about me up there? You know, you're just like, really? That's it? But it's because they can't ever admit that they did something wrong or that it was their fault or whatever, that they stuck themselves there. They're still not repentant.
Yeah.
Even when they're shown the example of everybody keeps going, oh, wait, why are there footsteps here? You're alive. What are you doing here?
Yeah. Yeah. And so there are so many. There's so many popes. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh my gosh, no.
There are popes all over the place in hell.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and they're not like in charge of anything. They're just there.
Oh no.
Yeah, they're there because of stuff they did. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So interesting. But the did you ask for the other one? There's one other part that just blew me away.
No, go ahead.
And that is the end. So in the last canto, we meet Lucifer. And Lucifer is just this giant figure that is basically locked in ice. You know, I imagine his like feet locked in ice. But he's standing there and he's eating people. And they kind of have
three faces.
Yeah, and he's got three faces. But he's like, they're climbing Satan, climbing Lucifer, right?
Well, they have to go down him. They go, they climb down.
Okay.
And then when they get to where his haunch goes through the ice, they, Virgil, if you read the description carefully, he turns upside down and then starts climbing.
And starts climbing, right, because he's gone down and now it's like gravity has flipped and now he's climbing up.
Yeah,
because
it's through the...
Because Lucifer's the center, yeah.
Yeah, because they said when... I loved this symmetry. When Satan fell, he created this huge space, right?
And
the earth
hole,
was afraid of him.
Right.
And what you find out when you start purgatory is what it did is it pushed out the mountain of purgatory on the other side of the earth, which I thought was really cool.
So even
though that was horrible evil... It provided a way for us to have redemption. So God used it anyway for us, which would just gall Satan no end.
Interesting.
I like that.
Yeah, that's cool. So earlier you mentioned, you know, highest wisdom, divine omnipotence, and primal love, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is sort of like the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Right.
And so here in the description of Lucifer, it says Dante, these are the notes. Dante presents Lucifer's head as a perverted parallel of the Trinity. The colors of the three single faces, red, yellow, black, are probably antithetically analogous to the qualities attributed to the Trinity in Canto 3 that you read. So it says, therefore, highest wisdom would be opposed by ignorance, which is black, divine omnipotence by impotence, yellow, and primal love by hatred or envy, which is red. And yeah, that's interesting stuff. I love it. So, oh, how amazed I was when I looked up and saw a head. One head wearing three faces. One was in front, and that was a bright red. The other two attached themselves to this one just above the middle of each shoulder. And at the crown, all three were joined in one. The right face was a blend of white and yellow, the left the color of those people's skin who live along the river of Nile's descent. Beneath each face, two mighty wings stretched out the size you might expect of this huge bird. I never saw a ship with larger sails. Not feathered wings, but rather like the ones a bat would have. He flapped them constantly, keeping three winds constantly in motion, to lock Cocytus eternally in ice. He wept from his six eyes, and down three chins were dripping tears all mixed in bloody salver.
Ugh.
And in each of his three mouths he crunched a sinner, with teeth like those that rake the hempen flax, keeping three sinners constantly in pain, etc. And later, just a little bit, the soul up there who suffers most of all, my God explained, is Judas Iscariot, the one with the head inside and legs out kicking. Yeah. We've talked about Judas before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of also, you bring up a good point, you bring up an interesting scenario because... Again, that modern look is we would never put treason as the ultimate sin. Think about these days, it would be, I don't know, some kind of a sexual sin or I don't know.
Yeah, very possibly. Yeah. And so the eighth and the ninth circles of hell. So like you said, the sins get more and more grave as you go down. But the eighth and the ninth are fraud, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like the ninth one is fraud against someone with whom you have a personal connection or a relationship with.
Right.
Right? So the eighth one is, you know, you've frauded somebody that you may not know that well. But once you have that bridge of trust, the fraud against the bridge of trust is the most grave sin there is, according to Dante.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's also interesting that throughout all that heat, you know, we've got people in holes getting their feet burned and everything. In the very bottom center of hell, it's ice. And, yeah. That's interesting to me, too.
There's, it was well put, and I can't remember where I read it, but it's like all warmth of love for God and fellow man has been extinguished.
Hmm.
And I guess in the places where it's hot, of course, because the sins are the punishments are reflecting what the sin really does. You know, that's, you know, the sins of passion and hatred and all these various things, but they can't even really have the passion of hating. It's a cold hate. And when you think about it, that's the sins you do in cold blood like that are really, especially against people that you like. That means you're totally betraying them.
Right, right.
You know.
Fascinating, yeah. Yeah, that's amazing.
It's kind of interesting to think about all these various circles of sin. And when you stop and think about them in our world, how do we view them?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to say Dante's got it wrong. I mean, I think I feel like he's right.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't have the same perspective because our whole society is not based on looking at what God wants. And not that his was, obviously. But they had a more kind of an internal knowledge of it, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Just from regular culture. Wow. One of the things that, speaking of the sin, the punishment fitting the sin that I liked,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I didn't like it, struck me,
yeah.
Was because it was unlike the other places to me, was the woods of suicide, the suicides.
Oh, the wandering people.
Right. Well, no, this was the woods where the souls of the people who committed suicide were in trees.
Okay.
So that to mm-hmm. talk to somebody, you had to break off a branch, and when the tree wept blood, it could speak.
That's right. Yep.
And it was so sad and melancholy, and that was what you were supposed to feel, I think. But the notes point out, let me read just a little bit of it. It says, not yet had Nessus reached the other side when we were on our way into a forest that was not marked by any path at all. No green leaves, but rather black in color. No smooth branches, but twisted and entangled. No fruit, but thorns of poison bloomed instead. No thick, rough, scrubby home like this exists, not even between Cecina and Cornetto, for those wild beasts that hate the run of farmlands. And what's pointed out is that these are all negative descriptions.
Hmm.
And it's the negativity of the suicide who denies the promise of life.
Wow. Yep.
And I just thought it not only showed his, it shows a little bit of how thoughtful his word choices and descriptions and everything were. And also, it's one of these places where the suicides are being left to themselves. I mean, people will run through there, like you say. There are wandering people through there, and there are chases or hunts or whatever going on there. And branches will get torn off, and they'll suffer and cry and bleed. But they've put themselves far away from everything, and they're kind of, okay, well, that's where you're going to be, you know. Just here in your woods by yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
Your fruit, which is poison thorns. So I had two other things that really hit me this time through. And there mm-hmm. are different things each time, which is what makes it great to reread. But,
oh, that's neat. Yeah. There's lots here for sure.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Yes. And I imagine if I read it enough times, I would care about who all these characters are and eventually know them too.
Right.
But one of the ones that hits me every time, and I don't know how people would not remember him, is Count Ugolino, if that's how you say it,
and his children. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know if you remember them. They're shut into a tower, and they're walled in eventually by their enemies, and they starve to death.
Hmm.
And it's a very affecting tale that he tells of, you know, my poor little children were, you know, daddy, why isn't there any bread? And they're gradually all just starving to death. And his children all die before him.
Mm.
And the way he ends it is very, I didn't look it up, but it's very nebulous. It's like eventually hunger overcame grief or something like that. And you're just like, or hunger did what grief did not or something. And you're like, does that mean you ate your children? Because he's in one of the lowest circles of hell under the ice, tearing away, eating somebody's head down there.
Wow. Yeah.
Or is he saying eventually I could, you know, feel what was wrong about all this. But the thing is that because he was hungry instead of sad and his children were dead. And I'm like, that doesn't seem right to me because then he wouldn't be in hell. But anyway, it's the story to me of how you could be in the deepest straits of hell doing the most disgusting stuff and still be using your little children to get other people to feel sorry for you. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the other one was just a real majestic scene that, again, was like, I don't know if I've ever read anybody who's written something like this, but there's a point where they can't get into this city. They have to get into Dis, the city of Dis, like Dis as in discord and that
right,
kind of thing.
Right, yeah.
And they won't let him in. And you're like, wow, I didn't expect Virgil to be shut out. And they're like, ah, go away. It's like Monty Python, you know.
Yeah.
They're like, I fart in your general direction.
And there is farting in this. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, aplenty. There's grosser stuff than that.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, so Virgil's like, don't worry. That's all right. Mm-hmm. I'm praying. Someone's going to come and help us. But at one point, Virgil's kind of, it's like his face turned the color of paper or something like that. And it's like, oh, Virgil's going. And he's going, well, I could have sworn someone was going to come and help. We were promised something. And then you hear this, like, you feel these huge steps coming.
Yeah.
And there's this huge figure that just comes walking on the water in case we're missing the comparison, and it's a giant angel who doesn't even care enough to talk to anyone or whatever, just kind of goes, I can't believe I had to come do this.
Yeah.
in more disinterested tones and words, and flips open the gates and then leaves again.
Yeah, like, and then just takes off, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
wow,
that's just an unforgettable scene.
It really is. Yeah.
You know, and, yeah, and also, I guess, on a personal level, it's that we can't see what forces are working for us when we're praying for something. We're afraid and we don't understand why things aren't working, but the angel's getting there eventually. So.
Right.
Oh, gracious.
Oh, I do love that. Yeah. I love angels.
Well, yeah. And this one was so angelish. It wasn't, you know, like a nice little sweet angel who tears and is going to hold your hand. Fine.
I always wonder what a real angel thinks of those little cherubs, you know, that you buy. I imagine one walking by in a mall and looking at that and saying, what is that?
Just like, oh, these people are so sweet.
That is crazy. Look at this porcelain thing.
Gracious.
Oh, shoot.
So,
yeah.
And of course, needless to say, there are so many images, and so many of them are just really disgusting. You can't yourself really dwell on them.
Yep, that's for sure.
But they're also not there just to be disgusting, which I think is how a lot of people might look at it if you're not thinking about what's it reflecting on your soul.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is saying something about what your actions did to your soul.
Right.
So I have to say, that's one of the things I was surprised at reading this book. Maybe the biggest thing is that it had a personal effect on me. I always wind up wanting to be a better person, and not that I'm afraid of I'll wind up submerged in shit, but it's just that I don't want to be that person who's so blind that I am so proud and so arrogant that I can't see what's true. All I have to do is be able to say, I can see what's true. I don't like it, but please help me. And that's all any of these people have to do, and they wind up there, and I don't want that.
Yeah.
So I don't know, did you have a personal reaction?
Yeah, my personal reaction was definitely reflection. When I was done, you know, not only were these images in my head, but, you know, the difficult images, you know, so there were the obvious thoughts about, you know, hell, what is it really? What do I believe about that? But I didn't come out with a fear of hell like you're saying either. But the reflection was really it. So I think it was similar. Because, yeah, these characters that are finding themselves in there are finding themselves that way because they can't seem to see it. Or their priorities are screwed up or something like that. So it is definitely a self-reflection. I did feel that as well. And how cool angels are.
Gosh. Well, would you recommend this to someone?
Of course, yeah. It's one of those things, you know, I can't remember if I said this at the beginning, but, you know, I'm really thrilled to have read this. It's like, you know, having this filed away. It's one of those things that so many people refer to that reading it, I think, opens up a whole lot of other things. So there's that aspect of it. But the other aspect is that it's worthwhile in precisely what you said about these characters and the imagery that sort of open you up inside and make you think about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's definitely worthwhile.
Yeah, and just the idea of reading Dante is very daunting. And
yeah.
And for some of the reasons we said, you know, there are all these references, but I think I would say if you want to try it, as I said before in another podcast where I was encouraging people to read it, is a canto a day is not a lot of reading.
No, no. And it's actually not that long a work. You know, you could fly through it really easily and get what you want out of it. But I think every time you read it, things are going to come up, like you said, and I have yet to read it my second time. But I will, because it's in there now, you know?
Yeah.
It's one of those things. So, But yeah, I mean, once you get through it and you've got some of this context, I think reading it a second time is probably really worthwhile and rewarding too, I bet.
Well, like a lot of reading, you know, you now have gone on the journey once. So you've got the adventure part down, essentially the plot down.
Yeah.
So you can kind of relax and spend more time thinking about the stuff on the way or noticing other things. I mean, how I missed that angel the other times, I know I read about it, but it just didn't hit me the way it did this time. The majesty and the, everything.
Right.
And there are things like Ugolino where you come to it and you go, oh, I don't want to read this again. But you kind of need to.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the other thing I wanted, the last thing, I guess, are we mostly done?
Yeah, I think so.
I wanted to mention is that even though this book is full of horrible images and everything, you see Dante progressing as he goes. He comes to not believe what everybody tells him. He comes to analyze it more. He's also being more reflective. And I have to say, one of the funniest scenes to me was when he's kicking somebody in the head who's stuck in the ice. And Virgil's like, yeah, now you get it. Keep going. That's it. Hate that sin.
Oh, my gosh.
And when he and Virgil are climbing out at the end, it says, my guide and I entered that hidden road to make our way back up to the bright world. We never thought of resting while we climbed. We climbed, he first and I behind, until through a small round opening ahead of us, I saw the lovely things the heavens hold, and we came out to see once more the stars. And I was being reminded when I was reading something that every canticle ends with stars.
Every canto ends with the stars.
Mm-hmm. And Inferno begins, of course, with the star. He's climbing up to the light.
Wow. I did not even notice that.
I had to read it, you know, so I didn't notice it.
You say canticle. So canticle. Inferno ends with this, not every canto.
Okay. Not canto, canticle.
I'm with you. So yeah, Inferno, and it started with the stars, too.
And purgatory and paradise.
Okay, because I remember when he went in, he said it was starless in hell.
Yeah, but he climbed, but in the first canto, he's climbing towards, how does it put it, that, let's see. He's climbing toward the light. He says, I raised my head and saw the hilltop shawled in morning rays of light sent from the planet that sends men straight ahead on every road.
Wow. Yeah.
What's that planet? Morning of Good Friday. So that's the sun, but that's a star.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and what I get from that, too, which may have been what he meant or not, but... You know, it's like my guide and I entered that hidden road to make our way back up to the bright world. We never thought of resting while we climbed, meaning they wanted to get out of there.
Yeah.
Right? They were not stopping. And then we climbed, he first and I behind, until through a small round opening, I saw the lovely things the heavens hold. It's as if now he sees the world completely differently.
Yeah.
So he's grateful.
He
sees it in a better light. And then we came out once more to see the stars. Yeah, it's beautiful.
It is. And it has the note of hope.
Mm-hmm.
It has the beauty. And for anybody who's been through a big experience or even the small ones, but I mean, it even makes me think of after I converted, my eyes were opened anew and I looked at everything differently. You know, it all looked the same, but underneath I saw so much more. And
oh, that's neat. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Too. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like a rebirth, right?
Right. Yeah. And that small round opening, that's like a rebirth also.
It sure is. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a beautiful sign of hope at the end of the book. And if people only read that, I listened to the Teaching Company course, which is simply fantastic.
Yeah. And I've been listening to that too.
Did you love
it. Yeah.
Those are the guys you've recommended to me. We listened to them for St. Francis, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I like William Cook did the history of the Catholic Church too, which is great course.
Which is really good.
Yeah.
And, but they continually, they've taught this class for a long time and they continually have mentioned through that, don't just read Inferno, don't just read Inferno. So I kind of took that to heart. And once I really finished going through it the second time, the whole thing, because I like Purgatory a lot, a whole lot. And Paradise was harder for me, as it is for everyone. But I could see their wisdom.
Interesting. So what do we have to look forward to then? In Purgatory, are we going through circles of purgatory? Is it the same type of a thing?
We're going through circles, but we're climbing the mountain.
Okay.
And so what we're seeing is, this is interesting because there's the antechamber, just like before.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see the correspondence with hell. In fact, I need to remember to look back and go, now what were they doing in hell at this point? But except there, it's the most serious sins at the bottom. And they go to the lightest sins because you're going up to heaven.
I see. Yeah.
And it's funny because you think Inferno is so inventive and interesting and nothing else can be like that. But Purgatory is just the same in terms of being really interesting, I think.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah. I really find it fascinating.
Oh, good. I can't wait.
Yeah. I love it. It's my favorite part.
Cool. And a canto a day will do me.
Yeah. We'll start tomorrow.
Yeah, that's right. Today, so later today, you bet.
Yeah, exactly.
That's great. Well, thank you. I can't wait to discuss Purgatory.
Oh, well, me either. And thank you for pushing us to read this.
Heck
because
yeah.
Just talking to you about it made me think about so many things I wouldn't have thought about otherwise.
Oh, that's
great. So
that's why we do it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And vice versa. Yeah, you brought up so many things. Yeah, I leave this podcast often. When we're done, I'm like, I need to read that again.
Yeah.
You know, with every single work that we do, it's like, oh, I need to watch that movie one more time.
I'm the same.
Yeah.
I'm definitely the same. And that's kind of why I said, well, let's do this, but let's follow what those teachers said, which is, you know, don't just read one part of it.
Right, right.
So, because that I have to make myself keep going too.
Yeah, and I'm glad we're doing it this way. We're doing three podcasts because that was the quickest hour imaginable.
yeah.
I feel like there's a lot more to say, but yeah, please, folks, give it a read. We'd love to know what you think about it too.
Yeah, yeah, I'd be curious. I know that Joseph was beginning to read it.
Oh, good.
So he could listen to the podcast. So if anybody else has been doing that, let us know. We'd be curious to hear.
Yeah, for sure.
So.
Cool. All right. Well, yeah, and next up, we're going to watch the movie Hot Fuzz, which is as serious as Inferno easy. And I noticed that Cornetto was mentioned in Inferno, so it's even more pertinent.
I forgot that. I did not make that connection. Yeah. Yes.
So this is great.
Yeah. In fact, I guess we probably should be eating Cornettos from now till purgatory.
I think we probably ought to. And that will have a place for us in the gluttonous circle.
Oh, yeah. That's my circle. Hopefully a purgatory.
That's one of my several circles.
Yeah. No, I know. It's I can't wait to talk about purgatory. But that's like you read about it, and you're like, oh. Could spend time. I'll be here and here. Oh, thank goodness I'm here.
Oh, shoot. You
know? Yeah, exactly.
Heck yeah. All right. Well, I'm looking forward to that. And then after that, of course, Purgatorio.
Mm-hmm.
So cool.
So start reading that canto a day, everyone.
All right. You bet. Well, thanks for joining us, everybody.
Yes. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.